The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to City Bible Forum today. Thank you for being here today. My name is Russell Matthews. We want to welcome you to the third part of the second series of the 2020 Vision, a look at Jesus' life. This part of the series is called Jesus, Mad or Majestic. I am the Resurrection and the Life is the name of the title today, and also the portion of the Bible that Ian Powell will be looking at today specifically. Today will be a little different. Ian's actually going to take on reading all of the portion of the Bible you'll see on the full of your outline. We do have a notes page there if you do want to take notes. Also inside of your outline, you'll find a small slip of paper that if you do have any questions about the series or about what some of the things that Ian brings up in this text in chapter 11 of John, please write the questions down on the small slip of paper. At the end of the talk, I'll come up and give some announcements explaining some of the things that will be coming up at City Bible Forum and what's going to be going on around the city. And then Ian will come up and answer as many of the questions that we can within the time that we have. So I'm actually my job's a little easier today, thanks to Ian. So I'm going to let Ian come on up and give a talk on I'm the Resurrection and the Life.
We just thought that we'd work through all 40-something verses. In fact, disappointingly, I was asked yesterday why I hadn't gone on to what happens after the story, and it's just lack of time, really. But since I'm going to read most of the passage, we thought it'd be more fun to just hear it unwind in the way that it's supposed to. Some years back, President Bill Clinton released to journalists a list of his 20 favorite books. And the interesting thing in the list was that he mentioned a book that is not popular, but important. And the title will indicate why it's not popular. And one of the helpful things that came out of it was this very significant book received a bit of airplay again for some time. It won the 1973 Pulitzer Prize. It was written by a man called Ernst Becker, and it was called The Denial of Death. Now, in this book, The Denial of Death, Becker explores research and then some very powerfully clear thinking that comes out of it on the significance that it is for the human individual and for the human community, our awareness of our death. The sense that we are threatened, the sense that in the end we will lose, and that what individuals do is try to build a sense of who they are that is some sort of armor plating against that awareness, against the discomfort of living with that consciousness. And he explores how many cultures, human cultures, are kind of us joining together to build up things that help us to forget our weakness and our sense of threat. Because death, as you know, and we've looked at this in Ecclesiastes, death, as you know, is the one great, inescapable, undefeatable tyrant. And there's nothing negative about saying that. That's just simply part of being a realist. And it's difficult to live well unless you've sort of faced this part of our life together. And it does mean that all of us, no matter how strong and fit and healthy and clever we may feel ourselves to be at various times, do end up, somewhat tragically and somewhat pathetically, either being killed by some accidental act of violence or being eaten away by some internal malfunction. And Becker, it was interesting that Clinton had that as one of his top 20 books. But Ernst Becker's book, The Denial of Death, is an appropriate background for John 11, which is a fundamentally wonderful and beautiful and exciting chapter. But it'll make no sense to you, and you'll get none of the power of it unless you're willing to take seriously what Becker talks about, our fragility and our struggle in various ways and times with this great fact. Well, let me read you. You've got most of the passage there in front of you, but if you just prefer to listen, don't feel pressured to pretend you're reading. And certainly don't feel pressured to take notes. I figure people probably weren't taking notes during the Sermon on the Mount, so I can hardly expect you to take notes on something as trivial as my conversation. It's lunchtime. You do what you like. Anyhow, John chapter 11. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. Pretty dull. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. Do you remember that? perhaps not. It's in chapter 12. It's a strange way to identify someone with something that he hasn't as yet told. I think it indicates some of the way in which chapter 11 and 12 tie together. Verse 3, so the sister sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one that you love is sick. When he heard this, Jesus said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. He brings up the topic of glory, which is one of the great passages, or one of the great themes in John, that God will be glorified through this. That is, his magnificence, his brilliance, his excellence will be seen through this man's sickness. And that will be done by God the Son's glory being seen. Now, I think it's fair to say that in Sydney, we have a glorious city. If you had a program on the glory of Sydney, I don't think they'd feature me. They'd probably feature the harbour, or the Opera House, or Clover Moor, or someone, you know, these magnificent things that we would all say, yes, this is what makes us great. And until you've seen Sydney Harbour and the Opera House and the Lord Mayor, you don't know nothing about this city, and you need to sort of open your eyes. And it's certainly true of Sydney, glorious city though it is, most Sydneysiders have never caught a glimpse of the glory of Jesus. They get much more excited about all sorts of trivial things than they do about substantial things. And we can know a lot about Jesus but know nothing of his glory. Jesus says, this sickness will reveal my glory. And this is one of the great themes of this passage. And what we see here firstly is the glory of the last laugh. Jesus says in the end, death will not have the last laugh in this sickness. Sickness is often the doorway to death. And he said, this particular sickness will not terminate in death. It will terminate in the glory of God. Here's what Jesus does. He gets the message, Lord, the one that you love is sick. It's a beautiful message, indicating the friendship that there was between Jesus and Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Jesus had often been in the home. There's obviously an ordinary human affection that Jesus has for this threesome, and they know that. He loves all, but there's an obvious just friendship here, which they appeal to. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so, this is the result of his love, so when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to the disciples, let's go back to Judea. Now, this is a strange way. So he hears that his friend is sick. Presumably, he's got something more than a little cold. Presumably, you don't send a message to Jesus when he's a couple of days walk away just to let you know. It's presumably, this is a sickness where really they're saying to Jesus, please come and help. We need you here. You can heal sickness. Here's someone who you love, and we love him, and we all love you, and please come and help. So what does he do? Because he loves them, he waits. He stays where he is until by the end of this section, if you have a look at verse 11, after he had said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going to wake him up. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better. It wasn't common in those days for the word sleep to be used as interchangeably a synonym or perhaps a euphemism for death. This has come out of the teaching of the New Testament where death has been transformed. It really is about as harmful for those who know Jesus as sleep. And Jesus says, he's asleep, I'm going to wake him up. They think that's a lot of trouble, particularly to go back to that area where they're trying to kill you, just to wake someone up. Deep sleeper. Verse 14. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Quite literally, in the word order in the original, it says, Lazarus is dead, I'm glad. Which was a bit odd. I'm glad for your sake. Not for his sake, but he said, this is good for you that Lazarus is dead. Now, you may ask if it's good for Lazarus and Mary and Martha, but I think you'll see in the end that it was. He loved them. That's why Jesus let him die. Little footnote here, and we're going to have a couple of little footnotes. I'd love to spend more time on the footnotes. In fact, the thing that has always grabbed my heart about John 11 is not the main point of it, but the footnotes, frankly. And one of the footnotes here is, do know that if Jesus loves you, he will disappoint you. He loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, so he left Lazarus to die. Do not ever team up with Jesus expecting now all your life hopes will be met. Guaranteed that won't happen. Now all your deepest longings and needs as a human being will be more than met. But again and again, those who love Jesus are disappointed. He seems to take too long to come through. He seems to keep us waiting. But his plans are always bigger and better. We'll see that, I think, as we go through. But that's just a little footnote. We may have another footnote later on. So here's the glory of the last life. Jesus says the last life in this illness will be the glory of God, not death. Secondly, we see the glory of a strong war cry. Now we're going to see Jesus do the equivalent of a haka, only better. Verses 17 to 27. Jesus sets out. Let's go to him, he says in verse 15. Thomas, who is a bit melancholy, Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us go along that we may die with him." Loyal, if not too cheerful. Verse 17. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. What's that? So he's buried on Sunday. So presumably either died Saturday. They tended to bury people within 24 hours because of the heat and the decomposition, etc. So he's been in the tomb since Sunday. Now, what that meant for the ancient world, we know this is true of the Zoroastrians in Persia and the Jews in Palestine, there was this general cultural understanding that the spirit may hover kind of around the body for about 3 days. But on the fourth day, the body went through such substantial changes in colour and internal organs began to explode and get messy that there was a general feeling at that point even the spirit said, "Bye-bye, body. I'm not hanging around here any longer." And it really is the fourth day. By that time, it's kind of like death has stormed the castle, dug some deep trenches, moved his artillery in. Ain't no one budging death from this man. He's 4 days dead. And that meant very clearly he's utterly, totally gone. Bethany was only 2 miles. It's interesting because Jesus says it won't end in death, and it certainly looks as if he was mistaken on that one, doesn't it? Because this fellow's well and truly dead. Verse 18. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. It's lovely. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. This is where Mary and Martha we see here, just in the tiny little verb sort of portraits we have, beautifully in character with the tiny little pictures we have of them in Luke's Gospel. Quite separate sources of the picture, but Mary and Martha, if you compare them in Luke 11 and John 11, absolutely in sync. Martha is a woman of action. She's a strong woman. She's a forceful woman. She hears that Jesus is in town. She doesn't wait for an invitation. She doesn't wait for him to come to the door. She's out to see him. And she's not all that impressed, I don't think, verse 21. It's hard to tell the tone of voice. But she says exactly what her sister says later on. Verse 21, "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." Hard to know the tone of voice. My own hunch is there's a bit of confusion, perhaps annoyance. We sent you a message. You knew he was sick. You didn't seem to be doing anything else except waiting. And you don't come and now he's dead. If you'd been here, if you hadn't sort of engaged in what seems like almost criminal negligence, my brother would be alive and we wouldn't be in mourning. Life would be completely different. Then there's a little moment of faith. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. She's got a sense that so close and so intimate is the relationship between Jesus and God the Father that perhaps even now, in an unheard of way, but that seems to quickly die back. Jesus answers her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha, verse 24. Martha answers, "I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Now, it's not uncommon for some of the semi-educated critics of Christianity and religions generally to say, well, religion's all about feeling good about what happens after death. You just got to not do some study to come up with that nonsense. Most of the religions of the world are not actually about what happens after death. Study them. Most of the religions that most people in the world have sort of come along with are about making sure that things are fertile and the rain comes and your wife has kids and your cattle has offspring and you don't starve to death. They're about life and fertility. The Jews, for example, had two very different groups. The Pharisees, who believed that there was a resurrection from the dead, which Jesus seems to agree with, and Martha as well. And the Sadducees, who were the most powerful group in ancient Israel, who did not. And if you were dragged along to Sunday school, they used to teach you that by saying things like, the Sadducees didn't believe there was anything after death, and that's why they were sad, you see. I'm sorry about that. That was a way to help you remember which of the two. The Sadducees didn't. The Pharisees did. So this is Jesus appeals to this belief. Martha believes it. Yes, she thinks that he will be raised at the last day, at the end of history. It doesn't happen in the middle of history. Right at the end when God burns up and reshapes and remakes the whole creation. He began it, he's going to cremate it and restart it. But then Jesus says this magnificent war cry, and he says it in a very, very dangerous place. Jesus says this in verse 25. Not the resurrection at the end of time that God will do on the day of judgment. Jesus says in verse 25, I am. Remember those words? Ego eimi, the double I. I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even though he die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Now, this is an extraordinary claim, and it's a dangerous place for Jesus to make it. If I stood up here and say, I am the resurrection, I'm pretty safe here because very few of you are going to be able to test me because you all look pretty much alive. Although, Russell, you're not looking too well in that sense. But, you know, but he's talking to a woman who's brother has just died. They're pretty close to the area where they buried everyone outside of Bethany. This is a dangerous claim to make in the presence of death to a woman who's mourning. I am resurrection. I am life. What does Jesus mean by resurrection? Well, resurrection is the reversal of death. It's the winding back of death. Now, we can do that if a person's only been dead for a few minutes, can't we? I've been watching Lost, this wacky TV program that one of my daughters is getting me addicted to. And, about every second person who dies gets brought back by the famous doctor who happens to be wrecked there. And it just seems as if every second person who dies comes back. Of course, that's not quite that easy if you've known people who died. You've got to be lucky to get them back, and you've only got a few minutes. But Jesus says, I am the one who can reverse death. I can wind back death. I am the death destroyer. I am the robber of death. I am the crusher of death. I am the death of death. I am resurrection. So then he goes on and spells that out by saying, in verse 25, anyone who believes in me will live even though they die. So yes, they may go through death. But he says, I'm the resurrection. I am not just able to heal the sick. I can defeat death. Now, as you know, if we got together the 50 most brilliant doctors in the universe and gave them an unlimited budget with access to every bit of technology on the face of the earth owned by every government, we cannot reverse the death of someone who's been dead for 4 days. Now, we can kill millions in an afternoon. That we can do. Killing we can do. Right? Really defeating death when it's not just stop breathing for a minute or two, but it's clinical death, the brain's dead and everything else is dead and the bodies are exploding. Can't do that. No matter how rich and how clever and how powerful, death is bigger than that. Jesus says, I can overpower death. I'm the resurrection. And he says, I'm the life. So if you believe in me, it will so transform the experience of death that you'll never die, really. It'll make it a completely different experience that he will call like going to sleep. It's a massive claim. Have you ever heard a claim like it? Can you think of any other serious person, or even a mad person? Have you ever heard anyone make a claim like that? I am the destroyer of death. I am the reverser of death. I will set the captives free from death. Ah, no, we have all sorts of nonsense in our culture about how death's a natural part of the cycle of life. Right? That's a thing. That's nonsense. Right? I've had people who've died who I love, and it was a good death, like their bodies were worn out, but it still stinks. And the more lovely the person is, the worse it is. And we learn to sing nicely in the face of death, but the reality is that death stinks. It's an enemy. And it works through things like age and sickness, etc., etc. And Jesus doesn't ever pretend, the Bible never pretends it's anything other than an enemy. And Jesus says, I am the one person who can defeat this tyrant. The Buddha couldn't. He died having been accidentally poisoned on mushrooms. Muhammad couldn't. Neither the Buddha nor Muhammad, the prophet, ever made a claim anything like it. Would never cross their minds to make a statement like this. Jesus says, I can not only change the psychological experience of death, I can reverse it. It's a fantastic war cry, isn't it? In the face of death, he says this. Well, it's a glorious war cry. Now let's move on to this. Is a bit odd because the third thing here is the glory of a soft-centered Jesus. What we see here is, in amongst all these words of great power, is a soft-centered Jesus. I worked at a school where most of the boys came from the North Shore. The tough and, you know, the really impressive kids came from the country. There were some impressive kids from the North Shore, but the headmaster, who was a great man, a really great man, used to have this dialogue he used to have with the boys, particularly when he first got there. He didn't like the way that when they played rugby, so many of them went down, you know, when they were slightly injured or, you know, a little bit knocked around, and they'd wait for the magic water to come on. And they used to talk about hard-centered chocolates and soft-centered chocolates. You often can't tell them apart until you bite into them. And suddenly what might have looked like, it's a soft-centered. And none of your boys are like soft-centered chocolates. You need to toughen up. And they did. And they did toughen up. And they stopped that nonsense about going down and calling for mum every time they'd been tackled. It was a blessed improvement for the first 15. So there's a sense in which being soft-centered can be a bit dodgy. But there's a very real sense in which the soft-centeredness of Jesus here is quite beautiful and quite wonderful. Martha has this conversation with Jesus. He says, I'm the resurrection and the life, and then says, do you believe this? And I wonder if John isn't actually throwing that out to the readers as well. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she said. I believe you are Messiah, Son of God, who was to come into the world. The next section from verse 28 to 37 is Jesus and Mary, the other sister, the soft-centered Jesus. Verse 28, after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and he is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Well, Mary comes, and she is, like she is in Luke 11, she's a contemplative, thoughtful, reflective. She sees Jesus, and unlike Martha, she falls at his feet in tears. Martha seems to have held herself together for a sensible conversation. Mary can't do that. She doesn't come to Jesus till she hears his call. As soon as she hears his call, she's up in a flash. She comes out with only one statement, the same one her sister had. Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not. Where were you? Where were you when we needed you? And now we're weeping our brother's death. And it could have been so different. If you'd been here, where you should have been, and answering our prayers and not disappointing us. When Jesus saw her weeping, the Jews who had come along with her also weeping. Now let me read it to you what it says literally. I became an Anglican minister some years ago, and you waste a lot of time learning. I'd refused to learn Hebrew. I just knew there was no way in the world I was going to master Hebrew. So all I could do was speak English. So they tried to bully us, but I said, no, I ain't going to do it. It's not compulsory for my degree. Go and bully someone else. So I didn't do Hebrew. I learned Greek, and that was kind of fun. And Greek's very, very, very easy compared to Hebrew. But frankly, it's a waste of time. The English translations are magnificent, and the gap between the Greek and the English is very small. The languages are so closely related. And any of the questions are normally in the footnotes, if there's a word that can go either way. This is about the only time where I think the English translators have let us down. You read any book, any commentary on John, they'll all talk about this. It's no great secret. Let me read to you what literally this passage says. Verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was outraged. Not deeply, well, he was deeply moved in spirit. It's a gutless translation. The word in the original language, the Greek, is a word for outrage and anger. It was used sometimes for the flaring of a battle horse's nostrils. You know, you've got this picture of a sort of a horse in battle, and it's been roaring around, and they've been hacking up the artillery, and it rears up, and it's a sort of picture of controlled anger, and the flaring of the nostrils was this word. It's a word for outrage and fury. And I think the translators couldn't bear to put down the fact that Jesus sees these people crying and he's angry. I thought that might lead to misunderstanding. But actually it leads to a wonderful deep understanding of Jesus. They're in the presence of death. And what does death do? Death destroys. Death tears apart loving relationships. The better the family, the greater the tragedy. The more lovely the person, the more awful the death. Isn't that how it works? And here's a family of love who Jesus loves, and they're all covered in tears because of death. And Jesus is angry at death. This enemy, as the Bible calls it, this intruder, that all relationships, every single life, all has this as its terminus, death and tragedy. We see that in verse 38, when Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It's the confrontation between Jesus, who loves us, and death, which destroys us and our relationships. This is what makes Jesus angry. And at the same time, it says Jesus weeps. The same heart causes the anger and the weeping. He's angry at that which has caused the pain, and he'll deal with that in a few seconds. But he weeps, why? The people who are there, they think it's because he's lost Lazarus. See how he loved him? No. He knows Lazarus is just sleeping. He's going to have afternoon tea with Lazarus. He's not missing Lazarus like we might do, right, when someone dies. What causes Jesus to weep is the fact that Mary is weeping. I mean, I take funerals sometimes as a minister. I hate them. I much prefer weddings and baptisms. But, you take funerals sometimes. I've taken funerals of people that I don't even know. I know nothing about them. In terms of ordinary emotional state, they mean nothing to me. I mean, they do because they're humans. But, they're not in the circle of people who really matter to me. But I find at times at funerals, and the longer I've been Christian, the more this is true, I can't bear sometimes to look at the nearest people to the person in the box. Because you see their tragedy and it's empathy, isn't it? You just get moved by their sadness. In fact, the Bible commands us to weep with those who weep and to rejoice with those who rejoice. And we're told in the book of Isaiah that even when Israel, God's people, were suffering because of their sin, it says in Isaiah 63, I think it is, in all their distress, he too was distressed. God does not sit back in heaven and say, well, life is rather tough, isn't it, kids? Well, it'll make you stronger. Or, well, if you hadn't been so sinful, death wouldn't have come amongst us. If Adam and Eve hadn't told me to get off and mind my own business, echoed by all of us, life would have been very different. He doesn't do that. He comes down, and what you see in Jesus, according to Jesus, you see him. Who do you see? You see him, Jesus, you've seen the Father. How does the Father feel when he sees us brokenhearted at the death of a loved one? He weeps with those who weep. That's what God is like. Very hard to hold together the magnificent, huge power of God and this tender, soft-hearted revelation of God. But that is what God is like. It doesn't answer. There are other questions you might want to ask about suffering. What it says, what is God doing in the midst of this? Well, he's going to deal with death, and he weeps with those who are weeping. That's a very important second footnote on the question of suffering. So we see here Jesus' soft-heartedness. Because he loves, he's angry at death. Because he loves, he weeps with those who weep. Fourthly, power and glory in the tombs. It's interesting how much of the big events in Christianity happen in cemeteries. Here's one part. Where have you laid him? Verse 38. Once more deeply moved, he came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take the stone away, he said. But Lord, Martha said, the practical one, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor. He has been there for 4 days. Did I not tell you, Jesus said, that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And Jesus prayed a prayer of thanksgiving. See what happens here? He's now in the grip of his anger and righteous fury. This great champion, this great lover of mankind, walks up to the death, its great celebration and crowning glory in a cemetery, all these family tombs that were there, one there for Lazarus and Mary and Martha's family. Take the stone away. Martha, at this point, respectfully, I think instinctively says, oh no, Lord. After 4 days, a tomb in a hot cup, there would have been a bad smell. And the beautiful King James translation, if you remember, it said, where it's translated, behold, Lord, he stinketh. Right? I think they should have kept the 16th century English just for this part. Behold, Lord, he stinketh, and he would have. So she doesn't, you don't want to smell the rotting corpse of the brother you love. She says, don't do this. And Jesus, trust me. So she does. They open it up. And then there's this moment where the tomb is open. Jesus has prayed. Everyone is still. Cemeteries have this effect on people both then and now. They're all still. And then it says what? Verse 43. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice. So there's this stillness and this eerie sort of disease. And suddenly there's a loud voice that says simply, Lazarus, come out. Not in the name of God, I call you to come out. Just the word of utter, pure authority. Lazarus, here. And it really is exactly the same way you'd speak to an obedient, well-trained dog. Right? With the complete expectation of immediate obedience. Lazarus, here. Jacob, Joseph, Joshua, stay where you are. Right? Lazarus, only. He's got to mention by name, otherwise the whole bunch of them would have come out. Would have been a complete circus. Right? Lazarus. And so the voice, I don't know how this works, but the voice somehow or other travels down into the realm of the dead and recreates and heals the body of Lazarus. Organs fixed up, ears remade, electricity running through the system again. And he hears the voice of Jesus. And he is brought back from the world of corruption and death. And there would be this weird, eerie hair standing up on the back of your head, silence. As everyone looks into the tomb and suddenly there's a bit of a movement. And then they see him shuffling out, wound up in the grave clothes that the Jews put him in, just shuffling. And then Jesus leaves this pause as people can see, my God, he's just spoken the word. And he is the resurrection. He has raised the putridly stinking dead. Jesus has to say, untie him. Even practical Martha doesn't run down to untie the brother. No one's moving. This would have been terrifying. But that is what he does. Jesus shows his great power, even over death. And that's why later on in the New Testament, the Bible has these statements like, you know, it mocks death. Oh, death, where is your power? Where is your sting? So John Donne, the great Christian poet, writes this, not because he feels like being a little optimistic, let's put a sort of a happy shine on a gloomy subject like death. That very famous poem that was read at a friend of mine's funeral fairly recently, death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, thou art not so. And that last great line, where he says, "The death, thou shalt die." So where do Christians learn to speak to death? They learn it from the New Testament. Where death, that great, inevitably omnipotent tyrant that will bring you to an end and will bring your children to an end and will bring everyone you loved, it will destroy every relationship you have, Jesus will speak the word and overcomes it. He is the resurrection and he is the life. And he has shown it by this act. Now the promise, just the last thing before I silence and give you a chance to ask questions. The response. The significance of this event, it's not just a one-off, oh, that was interesting, wasn't it? What a shame we weren't there to see it. The promise of Jesus, that I am the resurrection and the life, anyone who believes in me, though he die, yet will he live. That says it's not just an interesting event for Lazarus. But this triumph over death is now available to any who decide that Jesus is worthy of their trust. If you'll place your trust into him, he will resurrect you. Death will almost certainly devour us. Right? There'll be a funeral for you, probably, one day. But it will not have the last word. It will be like sleeping. You will rest. And then you will hear the voice of Jesus. And you will be resurrected. There's a great story that heads off for the rest of the chapter, into chapter 12, of the two very different responses to this. This, as we see in the end of chapter 11, this bringing back of Lazarus from the death is the death knell for Jesus. Having seen all the signs that he was doing, the powerful decided they had to kill him. There was no way to stop people being impressed with this Jesus. Apart from seeing the evidence, it was too inconvenient. But others, on the other hand, did the obvious and trusted him and rejoiced in his victory. And the words of Jesus, I think, come to Martha as to us, where he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this?
What we'll do is, because we're out of time, so what we'll do is, just brief announcements, but if you have any questions from the floor, if you do need to go back to work, that's fine. But instead of us gathering questions, how about if anybody has any questions, if you're courageous enough, just ask them from the floor, that would be great. And now, do you have any questions?
Yeah, it is a mystery. Did you hear the question? The Archbishop, he got it right on this thing about the translation. Made the same point that I did about the translations. Why don't they fix it? I don't know. I honestly can't work out this reluctance to say what... I think it's the fear that it will seem as if Jesus is being harsh. That they'll think Jesus is... And I've read commentators that said, you know, Jesus is angry at their lack of faith. Oh, that's baloney. Right? There's no reason why they would think Jesus was going to raise Lazarus from the dead. They hadn't even heard him say, this won't end in death. Martin Luther, the great German, he was the first guy he was the first guy to translate from the original into German. He uses the German word for outrage and anger. There's just a remarkable reticence on that, which I don't really understand. Any other questions before we go? I will be hanging around if you'd like to ask other questions, perhaps about the question of suffering and other things.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.